Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN in Geneva. Sorry for this delay. The reason for which we were waiting was that, as you have heard, there has been a terrible earthquake in Myanmar and neighboring countries, and we were trying to get somebody who can give you a sort of a short, brief information on what's happening there. The colleague is from the Federation of the Red Cross. She's not online. They are trying to get her, and also WHO has some update on that. So let's start with Gaza now, and as soon as we have the person on the line, we will try to have a little information from the field and from WHO on this earthquake. I understand that the conditions are very difficult there. That's why it's not easy for the person to connect. But in the meantime, let me start. And Sofia, can you come to the podium too? Let me start with Gaza, on which we have several colleagues briefing. We have with us Jens for an update from OCHA, Sofia Kaltrop, who has brought Maryse Guimond, who is the UN Women representative from OPT. She's connecting from Amman, and Margaret with Dr. Rick Peppercorn, representative of WHO in the occupied Palestinian territory. So I'll start quickly on this with Jens, then we'll go to Rick and Maryse. I believe Rick has a hard time to leave us, so let's try and do this a little bit brief. Jens, let me start with you.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. It is now day 10 of the return to full-scale war in Gaza after Israel decided to start bombing the enclave again. It has been 10 days of witnessing, because the UN remains on the ground in Gaza, a callous disregard for human life and dignity. The acts of war that we see bear the hallmarks of atrocity crimes. Hundreds of children and other civilians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on densely populated areas. Hospitals are once again battlegrounds, patients killed in their beds, ambulances shot at, and first responders killed. More than 142,000 people have been ordered to move again, with no safe place to go to and no means to survive. The area under Israeli displacement orders now covers 18% of Gaza's territory, and it is growing by the day. UN staff have been killed and injured daily, including by Israeli tank fire on a UN guest house on 19th of March that killed one international staff and injured six. We have demanded a full investigation of this. Palestinian rocket fire towards Israel has also resumed, and 59 people remain hostages. They must be released. All entry points into Gaza are closed for cargo since early March. Across the border, food, medicine, medical equipment, and other vital supplies are stuck. Inside Gaza, Israeli authorities deny humanitarian access to people in need. The progress that was made during the ceasefire has been reversed. The supplies of food and other aid we managed to bring in are rapidly running out. We are back to where we were before, just this time it's worse because of the complete shutdown of entry of supplies. We repeat, nothing can justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. International law is clear. It prohibits indiscriminate attacks, obstruction of life-saving aid, destruction of infrastructure indispensable for civilians' survival, and hostage taking. The International Court of Justice's provisional measures on the application of the Genocide Convention remain in place. Yet, the alerts that we issue in report after report reveal an utter lack of respect for the most basic principles of humanity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens, for this comprehensive update. And I'll go now to Rick Peppercorn for a brief description of the situation on the WHO side.
Thank you very much. I will repeat what Jens just all attributed to. Just maybe one, and that's more on a personal note. So I was in Gaza a bit more than 3 weeks ago again for my last long-term mission, and that was focused on the last round of polio, but also medevac and distribution of supplies. And there, you know, what we of course again witnessed That was before, just before when we came out, the aid blockade stopped. And what we witnessed, that this massive amount of people going back to Rafah to the south or to the north, Beit Hanun, Jabalia, Lahia, back to their damaged, destroyed houses and building up their lives again. We saw also a lot of commercial activities starting, you know, people starting to repair shops, etc. The food was for the first time, I could see, you know, was in relatively good supplies and more diversity, etc. And I think everything Jens describes, it is so hard to even imagine that all those people were there, this massive evacuation orders, and they have to get back as well. And that's what people told me all the time. And they're like, they want to be left in peace and assisted. Now, I want to focus on health. And for the evacuation order issued on 26 March, just to be specific, there in Gaza, Al-Uds Hospital is within the evacuation zone, according with two primary healthcare centers and the medical points. Other hospitals like Al-Wafa, Patient Friendly, very close to this evacuation orders, all of them remain partly functional. The massive efforts we put into restoring hospital, providing steady stream of supplies and stocks, despite the severe challenges. And there is 22 hospitals and 5 field hospitals partly functional. But it underscores the resilience of the health system and the need to protect it. So currently we see, and I think the focus is very much should be on food, water, and shelter, but also on the medical supplies, are dwindling quickly since the 2nd of March. No supplies can cross the Nazarene corridor. Fortunately, we had stocked up in our warehouse in the north and 2 in the south. But still, the trauma, for example, we are in the same pattern as we have been in the first 15, 16 months. Lack of trauma supplies, external fixators, fluids, antibiotics, blood, of course, which is all ready to be brought in. Less than 500 blood units are available at the moment in the blood banks in Gaza. An estimated 4,500 are needed per month. Lab supplies, equipment insufficient, the absence of functional microbiology, PCR, CBC machine, etc., critically impedes accurate diagnosis, etc., infectious diseases, the lack of anesthesia for surgery, labor and then the delivery pain, the analgesics, etc., and even the key supplies now for safe labor and deliveries, the so-called supplies for maternal and child health, will be running out out soon. I mean, we were running out. Limited availability of benzene, and has put out a dozen of ambulances out of use. EMTs, the lack of EMT entries, or the severely restricted, only 6 staff have been allowed to enter, 34 waiting. The lack of safe access across Gaza is constricting WHOs and partners to deliver. All missions need to be coordinated. So a lot of them are denied and delayed, etc. We have been conducted 4 missions, 3 medical evacuation missions, including 1 from the north to south and 1 to Nasser complex since the 18th of March. Medevac, slow down, closure of Rafah. So currently only 2 evacuations through Kerem Shalom, 22 patients, 49. And yesterday, 49 companions to Italy, France, and Norway, and Romania. And yesterday, 81 patients and 107 companions to the UAE. Healthcare must be protected. We saw the strike on Nasser, killing 2 people, destroying a 35 hospital bed. What is incredibly concerning currently is what's happening in Rafah. After 5 days, the PRCS team of 9 staff are reportedly still missing. We've been able to deliver health supplies for 5 hospitals and 1 field hospitals, and also 220,000 liters of fuel in this since the fighting resumed. But of course, it's absolutely not enough. We need emergency supplies for trauma and also for maternal and child health. So what's urgently needed, and I want to maybe repeat there my last sentence here is, of course, the resumption of ceasefire leading to a lasting peace, the lifting of the aid blockade, a safe access all over Gaza, resumption of medevac through all possible routes, protection of health, and finally, everyone wants to start on early recovery, rehabilitation, and reconstruction. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Rick, for this update. And now let me go to UN Women. Sophia, you want to say something before? No, I go directly to Maryse Guimond, who is the UN Women representative from Amman for the OPT from Amman. Maryse, bienvenue.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Alexandra and everyone. Allow me to continue like my colleagues. The end of the 10-year ceasefire in Gaza is having a disastrous consequences for women and girls. From the 18th to the 25th of March, in just 8 days, 830 people have been killed. 174 women, 322 children, with 1,787 injured. Let me break this down, because these are not just numbers. These are people. Every single day from the 18th to the 25th of March, that is an average of 21 women and over 40 children who are killed. This is not collateral damage. This is a war. Children bear the highest burden. They comprise nearly 60% of the recent casualties, a harrowing estimate to the indiscriminate nature of this violence. What we are hearing from our partners and the women and girls we serve is a call to end this war, to let them live. It is a situation of pure survival and survival of their families. Because as they say, there is simply nowhere to go. They are telling us they will not move again, since no safe places anyway. As a woman recently said to us from Deir el-Bala, my mother says death is the same, whether in Gaza City or Deir el-Bala. We just want to return to Gaza. This is a feeling that is shared by many other women I had an opportunity to meet during my last visits in January and February. Another woman from Al-Mirhaq tells us, we're glued to the news. Life has stopped. We didn't sleep all night, paralyzed. We can't live. My area is cut off. I'm terrified of being hit. Every possible nightmare races through my mind. This is simply no way of living. Since March the 2nd, humanitarian aid has been halted by Israel, and people's lives are again at risk since the Israeli bombardments resumed on March the 18th. The ceasefire, while brief, had provided some breathing. During that time, I had the opportunity to visit some of our partner organizations who were repairing their offices in Gaza City with what material was available. I saw neighbors coming together to clean some of the rubbles on their streets, heard children playing, met with women who expressed their fragile hope for peace and for rebuilding their lives. I saw thousands of people on the roads back to Gaza City. And now that hope is gone. For now, 539 days, the relentless war has ravaged Gaza, obliterating lives, homes, and future. This is not merely a conflict. It is a war on women, on their dignity, on their bodies, on their very survival. Women have been stripped of their fundamental rights, forced to exist in a reality where loss is their only constant. Cumulatively, over 50,000 people have been killed and more than 110,000 injured. It is crucial to protect the rights and the dignity of the people of Gaza, especially women and girls, who have borne the brunt of this war. Women are desperate for this nightmare to cease, but the horror persists, the atrocities escalate, and the world seems to be standing by, normalizing what should never be normalized. As we have seen in these nearly 18 months of war, women play a crucial role during times of crisis. However, after all this time, they speak of being trapped into a never-ending nightmare. This war must end. I and others have echoed their pleas countless times, amplifying the voices of the women in Gaza. Yet the devastation deepens. What will we tell future generations when they ask that we did not know, that we did not see? International humanitarian law must be upheld. The systems we establish to protect humanity must be respected. All humans must be treated equally. This war is shattering core values and principles. As UN Women, we join the UN Secretary General in a strong appeal for the ceasefire to be respected, for the unimpeded humanitarian access to be restored, and for the remaining hostages and all those arbitrarily detained to be released immediately and unconditionally. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marisa. Absolutely. Let's open the floor to question on Gaza now. To yes, Olivia Poitvin, Reuters.
Thank you, everybody, for this briefing today. Jens, if I may just start with you. You were detailing there that these acts of war bear the hallmarks of atrocity crimes. Could you just give some more detail on what you mean by that? And then just a question, please, for the World Health Organization. Just in terms of the blood units, sorry, could you just remind me of that statistic and what does that actually mean across the strip for people who are needing trauma care, for example? Thank you.
Let's start with Jens.
Thank you. I mean what I say, in the sense that what we're witnessing, the reports that we get, you get them as well. We send them to you every day. Bears the hallmarks of atrocity crimes. We are not, and I want to be clear about that, we are not calling them that. We are warning to the fact that this is reminiscent of the kind of behavior that is described in these kinds of international laws that I'm sure you know of. So that is what I mean by it. I think you can disaggregate it by going through our reports and see every day we have children being killed. We have aid workers being killed. We have people being forcibly displaced with no means for their survival to the places they're asked to go. All these elements are things that are described in those laws. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Enrique, maybe you want to take the second question?
Yes, so let me try. So first of all, I think, so what does it mean? I mean, like that, what we always see when the war resumed, or when the active fighting resumed, and we've seen this, I mean, over the last 18 months, specifically starting with trauma, that everything related to trauma is very quickly running short. So, I mean, the blood supply we mentioned, and which is insane. I mean, like, there's less than 500 blood units are available, and an estimated of 4,500 blood units are needed per month. WHO is ready to bring that in, at least part of that, etc. We are trying to, in discussions with COGA, we raise that every time, etc. But unfortunately, as you know, there's nothing yet allowed in. But also things like related to trauma, external fixators, is the device that stabilizes broken bones, the pins and frame outside the body. I mean, like, that's they run out. And even when we get back to the health workers, simple things like sterilization fluids, the infection prevention and control in most of the hospital because of the lack of proper water sanitation. So the number of infections are incredibly high even after operations. Then smaller things like lab supplies have been, we say, regularly in short supply, and they are again. And in short supply, and which will not help any diagnosis, as you can imagine. Specific focus again on anesthesia, analgesics, And but I just maybe want to maybe also want to make a point on the mother and child health. So the impacts on, for example, newborns. So at least 20% of the newborns are low birth weight, preterm or face another complication. They require more advanced medical care. That's already limited, and very soon it will be unavailable due to the lack of essential medical supplies. I think the UNFPA already raised this. They try to get in incubators, ultrasound devices, oxygen pumps, etc. All vital for newborns with complications. They also remain stuck at the border. And approximately 4,000 newborns are currently unable to access the essential life-saving care due to a major impact on medical facilities in the Gaza Strip. So every day without these ventilators, unnecessary morbidity increases and lives might be lost. WHO, we have more than 16 trucks in our reach with supplies ready to get in, like many other partners, I want to stress. So that should immediately have happened. This aid blockade should be lifted, and we should get those supplies in and make sure that we can distribute them all over Gaza. Over to you.
And Maryse, if you want to add anything, just raise your hand, whether physical or electronic. You have a follow-up, Olivia.
Yeah. Very quick clarification. Sorry, how much is estimated to be needed? You said there's 500 blood units, but I didn't, catch the figure of how many you would actually need. Thank you.
So approximately 4,500 blood bags per month. Yeah, and of course, when it is an active war and there's a lot of trauma, that might even increase. But so WHO, we were actually ready to bring in, I think, 2,500 blood bags. And we are consistently raising this, that this is absolutely a top priority, and we don't get in. So 8,000 units for trauma, but also diseases like thalassemia, 4,500 for trauma and complicated pregnancies, everything related to pregnancies. That is roughly what is needed per month. Currently, there's a huge need for that in relating to the many injuries which we are again seeing because of the resumption of violence. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Mohamed Aslan Anadoluansi, the Turkish news agency.
Thank you so much for this briefing. The Palestinian Red Crescent announced that they lost contact with 9 health workers in Rafah, which is the city sieged by Israeli army. The attacks still continue all over the Gaza. My question is, as WHO, are you in contact with all the health workers in the fields, or is what happened before the ceasefire repeating itself?
Rick?
Yeah, so we have the same reports on this 9 PRCS health workers, and we hope, like all of us, that we get as quickly as possible information, not for them, but also for their families, and what had happened with them, and we are extremely concerned, and I think OCHA is also very much in involved with that, trying to push for more information. We have, of course, a whole system in place with the Ministry of Health and Partners and WHO. There is a health cluster system, and they coordinate and they meet. Currently, it is very complex because of the insecure situation that is more difficult, so it will be much more what they can do online. But there is a system. We get all this information together. We have what we call also WERAMS, that is an information system focusing on all facilities, where we, as much as possible, it's of course a limited set of data and very much related to the humanitarian health support. But yes, we have that overview. Over to you.
Thank you, Rick. Other question, Isabel Sacco, Spanish news agency.
Yes, good morning. Do you have any figure about in the last 10 days of since the ceasefire was broken, what is the number of casualties dead people and injured people that, according to the reports from the hospitals that you may have, and what is the, what are the overall situation of the hospitals and of the health staff? Thank you.
Okay, so there is, of course, what we know that on 18 March, when there was this very intensive airstrikes, the camp on Gaza, then it was reported that there was over 400 people killed, like 450 people killed, and also hundreds of injured. The total figures since that, I've seen figures over 800 reportedly, and of course, overall, we talk now of more than 50,000 deaths and close to 115,000 people injured since the start of this crisis. Over to you.
Oh, yeah, you have a follow-up?
Yeah. On the situation of the hospitals and their availability to... The situation of the hospitals and their availability to work, to receive people, injured people, and if there you have seen attacks against health facilities?
No, definitely. Hospitals are still working. And I think I mentioned that 22 of the hospitals are partly functional in all this area. So they definitely, and even in Nasser Medical Complex, you heard about that that incident, that attack. Nasser Medical Complex is partly functional. They're still continuing in all areas. So all these hospitals are, not the 22, are partly functional. But the critical thing is that also for medical supplies, they will start. So we stocked up during the ceasefire. We stocked up very well in both our three warehouses, and actually brought most of the supplies we stocked up at the hospitals, and fuel, etc. But then, almost 4 weeks now of aid blockades, very quickly, you get a shortage of supplies. And I mentioned already in which areas. So that is definitely affecting the work at hospitals, including, I mean, simple things like the lack of access to clean water and cleaning materials, etc., which is not helping. And you see, of course, the whole infection prevention and control, which is essential for any hospital, that is severely challenged all over Gaza. Over to you.
Thank you very much. No other question in the room. I'll go to the platform. Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning. I just joined the briefing, but the cuts that you are having, the problem with the funding, is because USA funds, I mean, that they stopped the funding to WHO?
I guess this is for WHO, Gabriela. Yeah. Don't know if Rick, you want to take this or Margaret? No?
Well, maybe Margaret want to start. I can say something specifically on OPG. Margaret, you want to start?
Oh, well, sure. I'll just clarify with Gabriela. And we, you know, that as we've discussed, this is a very complex situation. Are you talking about the cuts to the recipients of USAID funding? Are you talking about cuts to WHO? Or are you saying, is the general reduction in U.S. funding to the different health services affecting our work in Gaza? Is that what you're really saying, Gabriela?
Yes, that's what I'm really saying, what you said at last, yeah.
So over to you, Rick.
We can't hear you, Rick. Oh, no, it's fine. No, it's fine.
Okay, so... I think here in this response, the WHO operational response in the crisis in OPG, both Gaza and the West Bank, I think we did very relatively well in the first kind of phases on humanitarian health support. And fortunately, we have a plateau of partners, so almost 30 partners. The US, of course, is an important partner. So I mean, if I just put it in figures, the group, the EU and the European countries are for us our largest group of donors here in OPG. But we, as I said, we also have other countries. I can mention as many besides the European, Canada, Korea, Japan, Saudi Arabia, UAE, etc., etc. The US, next to the European countries, was, I would say, the second biggest donor with 60 million, 30 million we were used for that. So roughly 47 million is unfortunately part of that aid freeze, which we had planned for all the activities which are critical. Primary and secondary care, trauma, emergency care, sexual reproductive health and services, surveillance, medevac, the supplies, etc. So we have had good discussions with a wider group of partners, and we can continue for the moment what we are doing. But I'm deeply concerned because the WHO, having been key in, for example, for the essential medicines, medical supplies in Gaza, at one stage more than 80% came through WHO. We have allocated another 90 million and we are okay for the next 3 months. I mean, in that sense, if we get them in, if the aid blockade is lifted. But after that, I'm seriously concerned. And this is what we now have a discussion with all the partners. And I think we get some good positive feedback. We need to maintain that supply of essential medicine, medical supplies and equipment. Then we have to maintain supporting the emergency medical team. And health teams and health systems, the medevacs, etc. And I'm not even talking about what we all want to start with is early recovery, rehabilitation, and reconstruction. So yeah, there's massive funding gaps which need to be this needs to be addressed, and it's a huge request from us from here. I have to stop here. I have to actually quit to another emergency event. Is that okay?
Yeah, yeah, I knew that you had to leave. There were more questions, but maybe if they were for you, Margaret can pick them up and then report them to you. So thank you very much, Rick, for being with us until now. Maryse is still on the line and colleagues here, so I'll give the floor. Gabriela, you had a follow-up, but probably it was for Rick, was it?
Well, in fact, it's, for Margaret, it's okay. Mm-hmm. As we heard from Rick, it's important the lack of funds due to a USA decision. But I would like to say, I mean, not USA decision, Mr. Donald Trump decision, because USA is a nice country. I mean, the people are nice, but this is a decision of Donald Trump. So maybe we can say that to clarify, because no. Well, that's it. But if you just can elaborate that, Margaret.
Sorry, I don't really understand your question, but yours anyway. Certainly, the new U.S. administration has made a lot of different changes, and as you know, WHO, like many many other of our sister agencies, is now looking at how we can continue to do our work with less. Or look for other ways to fund our work. But the top line message is that we are not going to stop doing what we're here to do, which is to protect health, serve the vulnerable, keep the world safe from disease.
Yeah, and later on we will also hear from the UNHCR on the effects of funding cuts on the health, in that case of the displaced people, in the world. We'll hear more about that. But I've got still questions, and as I said, the colleagues are on the podium, and Maryse is still in Amman and connected with us. So I give the floor to Nick Cumming-Bruce, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking my question. Jens, you talked about ambulances getting shot at and first responders killed. I've seen some of the reports of ambulances being shot at. Do you have any more detail about first responders killed? I don't think I have clarity on that. And for Margaret, I'm afraid I'm a bit confused by Rick's numbers. I don't know if you can clarify them. 47 million was part of the aid freeze, 16 million was missing. Could, if you're able to shed some light on exactly what has been affected what money has been withdrawn since the change of administration. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. I would consider anyone working in humanitarian affairs in Gaza a first responder, be it UN, NGO, or others working on this. I can try to get you more examples of that I can send to you.
On Rick's numbers, I'm just sending a WhatsApp right now to his team to ask him to get those really clear for you, and we'll get back. If I get it back quickly enough, I'll send it to everyone, but I'll definitely send it to you via email, Nick.
Thank you very much. Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Thank you, Alessandra. My questions are for Jens and for, well, it would have been for Dr. Peeplecorn. Maybe Margaret can help. I wanted to just get a sense about how long you think that the people can sort of go on, given the situation right now in terms of the blockade of aid deliveries. I mean, if this continues, how much longer can they go on in terms of food and medicine? And then the question for Jens more specifically is, what are you hearing about Israel taking over distribution of aid? Is that actually moving forward, or is it just talk at the moment? Thanks.
Thank you. I give the floor to Margaret. But Maryse, if you want to add anything to this, please let me know. Margaret.
Sorry, I was talking to my colleague in Gaza. Can you
how long people can go ahead with what they have with in terms of food, medicine, and
not long. We're looking at a situation right now that is as bad as it ever was. We knew it was bad before the ceasefire, when we were constantly begging to be allowed to do our job and just to help the ordinary people of Gaza to live their lives. It is now worse, that because people have had a blockade of food, but they've also got the ongoing fighting and the supplies are running out. And they're exhausted. And this is on top of a situation where they were already very unwell. So, no, they can't keep going. And that's why we're saying we need this to be lifted right now. We need a ceasefire right now.
And the opening. Maryse, I saw your hand up. I don't know if... Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, but I would like to reiterate what Margarita just said. I mean, and that's what we're hearing from the women across Gaza. I mean, this cannot continue. And they're very clear on that. They just cannot continue on this. I mean, when you're calculating the number of days that people have food for, so it's really important that, one, the aid, humanitarian access is restored, but also that the ceasefire is effectively also restored. Thank you. And I'm saying, this is what we're hearing across the Gaza Strip from the women. Thank you.
Thank you, Jens.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. On your first question, different kind of aid works in different ways. Food works in a particular way. Shelter works, obviously, in another way. Medical equipment is one kind. Medical medicines, consumables are another kind. So it's very hard to give an overall idea or, you know, number of days or weeks or whatever to say at this point it's going to run out. What we hear consistently from all partners is that it is running out, and it's running out very, very fast because there's nothing coming in, and it has been so since the 2nd of March. So I will invite you to go to, for example, WFP to ask them. I have numbers here, but they are their numbers, so I prefer that they speak to them about what they still have and how fast it actually is running out. Thank you. On the second one, it's quite easy. I have nothing to report on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I see Catherine and Gabrielle on the line. We have people waiting in the field to brief you. So is Catherine, is this on Gaza?
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. It is for Margaretha.
Okay.
It is for Margaret. I have a question for you also, Alessandra, but as you requested in the chat, I'll wait a bit later.
Thank you.
Margaret. Our colleague Gabriella did ask a question related to the cut of funds. And I'll come back to the kind request which was placed by ACANU 2 months ago about getting a briefing on the situation and also getting a briefing of how far and how strong you are affected. Would it be possible, please, to organize that?
Thanks, Katrine. And as you know, we are doing our best. But as you also know, because you're reporting on this situation, it's so fluid. It changes every day. And at the same time, every department, every country office, every regional office, everybody is looking at exactly that. How are they affected? What can they? How can we do what we need to do with less? In other words, do more with less. And we still, I know you're frustrated. It's frustrating for everybody. We still don't have the clarity that would make it a worthwhile briefing for you. But when we do, you're top of the list.
Thank you, Margaret. Gabriela and Jamie, very quickly, and then I'll stop the question on Gaza because we have our colleague in the field, Tanning, wanted to tell you something about what's happening with the earthquake, and I think you all want to hear her. So, Gabriela, please, very quickly.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Very quickly. So you are talking about women and children in Gaza and everything. So is this a collective punishment? Would you qualify that as a collective punishment?
Maryse?
I'm sorry. I would refer this question to you, to my human rights colleagues to respond on that. Thank you.
Yeah, they're not here today. Anybody wants to take the floor on that? No? Okay. So very last question, Jamie.
Thanks. WFP is also not there. Jens, could you please give us the numbers that you have from you, WFP? Thanks.
The numbers on the food distribution.
You're going to get me in hot water, Jamie, here. But according to the World Food Programme's latest operational update, the agency has about 5,700 tons of food stocks left in Gaza, enough to support its operations for 2 weeks at most.
Thank you very much to you all. Thanks, Maryse, and you'll thank Rick for us. Margaret, thanks, Maryse, to be connected, and thanks to your colleague here in Geneva, Sophia Kaltrop. I would keep Margaret on the podium, and we will connect now to Marie Manrique, who is, let me find your titles, madam. You work with the International Federation of the Red Cross, and I have your title somewhere.
It's okay.
Yeah, coordinator of the IFRC Myanmar Country Delegation, and you are connecting from Yangon. Thank you very much for being with us. I imagine it's not easy at the moment to be connected with the other side of the world. Margaret, do you want to start say something? And then we go to Marie.
The earthquake.
Earthquake, yeah.
Just to say that we've set up our incident management system. It's being coordinated from Geneva because we see this as a huge event. We've been in contact with our staff. Most are safe, but the damage is enormous. We've activated our logistics hub to look for, particularly for trauma supplies and things like external fixateurs, because we expect that there will be many, many injuries that need to be dealt with, and we've been started the health needs assessment. But over to a colleague in the field who knows exactly what's going on.
Yes, Mary, please tell us what's happening there, what you see.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. So, speaking from the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies here in Yangon, Myanmar, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to actually share a little bit of the update on today's two large earthquakes. So at approximately 12:51 p.m. local time, there was a 7.7 magnitude earthquake in the northwest of the country. And then less than 12 minutes later, we had a 6.4 magnitude earthquake not in the exact same area, a little further south, but also in the northwest of the country. However, the tremors were felt throughout the country, including in the country's south, as well as in the largest city of Yangon, where I'm based. Here in the Myanmar Red Cross building, where I'm actually based, we also had to evacuate. I understand that the impact has been felt as well in neighboring countries. Thailand, China, and India have also been reporting feeling the impacts of these large earthquakes. One of the things that's quite important is to understand not only the buildings that have cracks and tremors or fissures in them, but also collapsing buildings and public infrastructure has been damaged. This includes roads, bridges, and public buildings. We currently have concern for a large-scale dam that people are watching to see the conditions of the dam. We also know that the major bridge that connects Mandalay to Sagaing has also collapsed. This is going to cause a logistics challenge to reach people in Sagaing. Sagaing is in an area that is currently affected very strongly by the protracted crisis, has the largest number of internally displaced people in the country. We also know electricity and communication is down in several areas of the country. The Myanmar Red Cross Society has activated its emergency response. So staff and volunteers from the Myanmar Red Cross Society are on the ground and helping as possible. Currently engaged in what I would say is very rapid assessments and trying to help out as possible. The conditions are quite challenging, but the support that they're able to provide is vital at this time. I have very preliminary information gathered from the Myanmar Red Cross because they're in contact with their branch networks throughout the country. The main impact areas are Sagaing, Mandalay, Maguey, Shan State, Nepito, and Bago. We're working with very limited information at this time. We will know the scale of the damage as we move forward, but we can imagine, as our colleague already said, that the impact will be quite significant. And this will even be particularly worse for those people in situations of vulnerability due to the protracted crisis in country. We will have a clearer picture in the next few hours, but I would really like to say that we're very concerned about the potential humanitarian impact. And really, it's a developing emergency, and our priority is to ensure that affected communities receive the help that they need as quickly as possible. And we stand by as the IFRC, ready to scale up our support as the needs become clearer and access allows. So thank you for your time, and we'll keep you updated as the situation evolves.
Thank you very much, Betty. If you can stay on the line, there are a few questions for you and maybe for Margaret. I'll start with Isabel Sacco, Spanish News Agency.
Yes, thank you very much for being with us. Could you please tell us who is monitoring the situation of this dam that you mentioned? Is the central authorities or is someone else? Secondly, about the collapse of the bridge that will make it difficult to access people that could be affected. And you said that in that region, that where these people is cut maybe from help. This is a region or a place where there are a lot of IDPs. That's what I understood. Could you just give more details on how happens that they are there? Who are they? How many are they? And also, what do you know about the mobilization by the government, maybe by the army, to help the affected people?
Marie,
thank you.
We can't hear you anymore. I see your mic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good. I was having problems with the
speech. That's fine.
Please just know that right now we're focused on the emergency response, trying to gather the data about what is happening within the country. In terms of the situation, the dam, this is information that we are gathering from people that are in those regions. But I imagine that local authorities are also following up on this, including the issue of the Ava Bridge, which is the bridge that's connecting Sagaing to Mandalay. We will see further what that means. In terms of the number of IDPs in country, you know, there are 3.5 million IDPs in country, with the northwest of the country being one of the areas most severely affected. This is, as you mentioned, an area of great concern for all humanitarians, and we will continue to work with the Myanmar Red Cross and the Red Cross movement generally to make sure that we can support in the humanitarian needs going forward. Further information as we receive the assessments from the field. Thank you.
Olivia Potvin, Reuters.
Thank you very much, and I hope your colleagues are safe and well. Just a question, just to get a sense of scale. I appreciate it's very early days, but are we talking about kind of hundreds or thousands of buildings that have been damaged or collapsed? Any kind of sense just of the scale would be helpful. Thank you,
Marie.
Okay, thank you. So at this time, this is very preliminary information. So the Myanmar Red Cross Society, with the support of the International Federation, has activated its Emergency Operations Center. I don't want to quantify the numbers because we don't really know what they are, but given the scale of the earthquake, we can imagine that the impact is quite large. Please keep in mind that some of these locations, some of the infrastructure might not be that modern. In other cases, infrastructure is quite modern. So we just need to see, based on the impact in the certain states and regions. Six states and regions are currently considered the most impacted. I named them when I was speaking initially, but we need really to remember that this is not just focused on the northwest of the country. It's also focused on the central dry zone area, as well as the southwest of the country is largely impacted.
Thank you very much. Robin Millard, AFP.
Thank you. Margaret, could you tell us a little bit more about this incident management unit that's been set up? How will that operate and what will it be doing? And for OCHA and for WHO, what sort of stocks and supplies of things do you have that you're sort of starting to prepare to move into the region? Do you have those sorts of things lined up, and are they already on the move? Thank you.
Yes, so the incident management system is something that we initiated actually after the big West African Ebola outbreak, when we realized that when we get a signal of something really serious, we need to go into what's called no regrets mode. We start immediately, not wait to get the information, but start immediately. And because this one is clearly a very, very big threat to life and health, we have already said this is managed from headquarters in conjunction with our regional teams and our country office. We do have a country office in Myanmar. We also have one, of course, in Thailand. And we have a special cell to deal with Myanmar, because Myanmar has already been suffering a lot from conflict and other issues that are very much part of the work we do to support and protect the health of people. As far as supplies, we have a hub in Dubai, and we've already looked at what we've got there. The main things you need in these sort of circumstances are trauma supplies, ensure that you can get in essential medicines and other things to people, because they may have their health infrastructure so damaged that they need to have extra medical supplies. But the main thing will be trauma at this point, because of the injuries people are likely to have. We've got a lot of experience with earthquakes. Unfortunately, we had the big Turkey earthquake. So we know very well what you need to send in first. And we've got somebody in Bangkok set up. We'd actually done an assessment of best ways to get supplies into Myanmar just by chance, but that had already been done a few weeks ago. So we are ready to move in, but now we have to know exactly where and what and why, and it's information from the ground, just as we've heard, that's really critical right now.
Thank you very much. Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Thank you. Could you repeat us, please, where was the epicenter and the grade of the earthquake?
Mary, could you repeat what? Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So the epicenters for the earthquake as well as the aftershock were in Sagaing, that is in the northwest of the country. The first was northwest of Sagaing City, Sagaing region. The second was south of Sagaing City. Did you want the actual, so one was 7.7 and the other is 6.4.
Thank you very much. I think that's what she was asking. Christian Ulrich, German news agency.
Yes, thank you. This is also a question to Marie. Can you tell us how many people live in those six areas that you think are mostly affected? And I'm not talking about IDPs only, but total population. And second question, being as old as I am, I was in the region when Cyclone Nargis hit in 2006, I think, and it was impossible to get supplies in because the military government was very secretive. Do you expect more openness from the military authorities at this point, or do you see already problems getting helpers and materials into the country? Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much for that question. Right now at this time, we're focused on trying to get assessments and responding to the needs in the field. So I don't think that we can really discuss what potentially other actors might be engaged in. So for the IFRC, we will continue to support on what is emergency needs assessments and particularly reaching people in need. And in terms of the people who are in these locations, very generally just focused on the Northwest, we're probably looking at about 18.5 million in the immediate areas that could be affected in the Northwest of the country. That doesn't include all of the six areas.
Thank you. Catherine Fiancon, France 24.
Yes, question to Marie. Marie, please, can you tell us the state of the communication facilities? Because in order to work properly, I suppose that you need to be able to communicate. And maybe if there's someone from ITU around, it would be interesting to know if they did activate that emergency facilities into communication when there are problems in the world. They have those emergency groups, which are a little bit everywhere on the different regions, in different regions of the world.
Okay, I give the floor
to Marie. Just speak to what would be the commercial telephone lines, and then I'll hand it over to another colleague to respond to those other questions about what's been activated within the UN system. So commercial telephone lines, many of them are out. There are probably four potential lines that can be used in country. There is one that we've been able to establish communication on, but that's all that we know currently at this time. Over to you.
There was one colleague from ITU, but she dropped off, so I can only bring your question back to them, Catherine. Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to follow up. Could you give us the spelling of the name of the dam that you're talking about that there's concern about? And do you have any details about how many people may be buried underneath the rubble in the building that collapsed in downtown Bangkok, if I understand correctly? Thanks.
Okay, I'm not familiar with the information from what's happening in Thailand. We just heard that you do have some UN colleagues that are in Thailand, so perhaps you can answer that question. And with regard to the dam, there are several dams. Actually, you know that the largest body of water flowing through the country is the Irrawaddy. So there are several affluent, I don't know what you call them, connecting rivers to that. So that's the concern. There are concerns on several dams. It's not just one in particular, particularly because as we saw what the impact was on other infrastructure. With regards to the other damage of people within country, as I mentioned, it's still ongoing to receive the assessments, not just from the MRCS, but as well as other institutions. So over to the colleagues that have the information on Thailand.
I don't think this has been very, very much of a last minute intervention, and we still don't have here in Geneva much information on the earthquake. And I'm sure colleagues from the humanitarian agencies will definitely come back to the journalists with more information on the situation also in Thailand. And that's why we are so happy to have Marie here. I'll take a very last question, Gabriella, because afterwards we still have several colleagues who have to brief. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Alessandra. You always tell me that this is the last question. I would like to ask, for example, in Mexico, we are very sensitive about earthquakes. So people want to help. So what is the best way for people to help in this matter? I mean, individuals, not you know, organizations. Individuals. How can they help? Thank you.
Marie?
Okay, thank you. I think one of the things that's quite important to understand that the first responders are the people who are in the communities. So of course, I'm coming from the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement. So I'll speak about the importance of supporting through the Red Cross, Red Crescent. However, no, the UN is probably looking at if they are going to determine what the response will be. In our case, we are generally focused on how we can work with the Myanmar Red Cross to have the emergency response plan. And then we will probably, and I want to say probably, we're looking at the possibility of launching an emergency appeal.
Thank you very much. And I see that Tommaso of De La Longa from IFRC has put some information on the in the chat. One was about Palestine before Mohammed, that I think was for you, and then also an answer to Jamie. So have a look at the platform, Jamie. And thanks, Tommaso. So thank you very much to Marie for coming in like very, very last minute to tell us about the situation. Good luck, stay safe, and if possible, give us updates on the situation in Myanmar. We
thank
really
you for
hope.
Your time.
That would not be too catastrophic, but from what we hear, it is going to be very dire. So, and I'm looking at Margaret too. Thank you so much again. Let me now move to UNHCR. UNHCR William is here with Alan Mina, who is the public health chief of UNHCR. I had already started telling our journalist, Alan, that you were going to tell us about funding cuts and the threats that it poses to the health of nearly 30 million displaced people. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me here today. As you rightly noted, I'm here to talk about a very worrying situation. A very worrying situation. With close to 13 million displaced people, including over 6 million children, at risk of not being able to access life-saving health and nutrition care and having devastating consequences in 2025. The current funding situation complicated by declining health expenditure at country level is affecting the scope and quality of public health and nutrition programming that we're able to provide for refugees and host communities around the world. The result is that we are seeing a disruption in access to essential services, increasing risk of disease outbreaks of malnutrition and treatment, lack of treatment of chronic diseases. We're also seeing a rise in mental health issues as a result of this funding situation. Just to note that when the funding cut is reduced for the refugee healthcare, it's also affecting the host communities around there. And refugees themselves are facing increased barriers, including being able to pay from their pocket. Right now, the situation is forcing many of them to have to pay more with funding that they do not have. It's also resulting in access and them having to receive or seek access in strained public health services, and also resulting in an overwhelming of the local clinics and hospitals. As a result of these funding cuts, it's not just affecting health, but it's also affecting water supply systems. It's affecting sanitation facilities, waste management. And this is associated, as we know, with increasing risk of outbreaks of infectious diseases like cholera, hepatitis, malaria, and others. And it's threatening populations around the world with devastating consequences. The funding reduction as well could significantly reverse the progress we've made globally in HIV, including in humanitarian settings. I'll just highlight some key examples of the situation with the funding. I'll start with Bangladesh, where we have close to 1 million Rohingya refugees facing a severe health crisis as a result of the funding situation. We in UNHCR supported programs which we fear that over 40,000 pregnant women will have challenges accessing critical antenatal care services, including some 5,000 women having to make choices on how to deliver in safe conditions. Additionally, about 19,000 acutely malnourished children run the risk of not being able to receive life-saving treatment, and about 10,000 people or children communities will have challenges accessing secondary healthcare services. In addition, in total, we're seeing about 200,000 refugees in UNHCR-supported services having challenges accessing services, including for mental health and psychosocial support. Furthermore, and very worryingly, is about 10,000 refugees may not be able to access hepatitis C treatment, further complicating a very dire public health situation. Without immediate funding support, the health system will collapse in these camps and put thousands of lives at risk. If I move to Burundi as well, we see that some 10,000 pregnant women could lose access to antenatal care, and heightening the risk of complications and preventable maternal deaths. We also worry that the local health facilities, and something that we're seeing in various countries, are overwhelmed in are located in underserved areas, and they're having to work beyond their capacity. The patient numbers are increasing, and we're also seeing outbreaks increasing. In Burundi, we've also already seen 11 cases of cholera reported in Cibitoke province. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, we're seeing the healthcare system is on the brink of collapse. Financial resources allocated to the health sector are not adequate to meet the urgent life-saving needs. In the 2025 UNHCR health budget has been cut by close to 90% in 2024, triggering severe and immediate consequences. Health facilities are overwhelmed, there are critical shortages. We're seeing medical staff reduction in medical staff and supplies. Facilities are running out of medicines, and referrals to secondary care are not guaranteed. Disruption to the water supply system has also led to reported cases of cholera. The health consequences of the funding cuts are expected to be devastating and puts over 520,000 refugees in the country at risk of infectious diseases and death. If I move to Egypt, another example there where we're seeing that medical treatment for refugees has been suspended, except for emergency life-saving procedures. The suspension includes planned surgeries and treatment of severe conditions. And medication for chronic diseases such as diabetes and hypertension, which if untreated, of course, as we know, could have dire consequences. At least 20,000 patients are affected, including many refugees who fled the war in Sudan. We're talking about people here. We talk about men and women. We talk about fathers and mothers. We talk about children worried whether their father or their mother, who might have a chronic condition, is not able to access treatment, and whether they will live to see another day. It's very worrying and very acute situation. In Ethiopia's Gambela region, funding cuts have severely impacted the nutrition services, leading to closure of operations in 4 out of 7 refugee sites. We had an unfortunate situation where 9 severely malnourished children had to be discharged immediately because programs had to close. And that increases the risk of them, of their death, actually, because they had to go be followed up through outpatient services. Related to the malnutrition situation in Gambela, we're seeing about 980 acutely malnourished children only being served by 2 staff, about a third of what is needed. We also seen that 80,000 children under five are at risk of life-threatening malnutrition, increasing child mortality rates and the antecedent consequences to the affected communities. In addition, the shattering of community-based programs for sexual and reproductive health will likely lead to an increase in maternal and newborn deaths. In Jordan as well, 43,000 refugees are at risk of losing access to primary care and cash for health programs, putting some 335,000 women of reproductive age at risk of not receiving essential services for maternal care. Mozambique's Maratani refugee settlement in Nampula province hosts some 8,000 refugees and asylum seekers. And when you talk about solidarity, this is a place where the host communities appreciate the presence of this settlement. They're able to access services just as at par with the refugees in this site. Last year, UNHCR-supported healthcare center in Maratane was able to provide over 80,000 consultations. Unfortunately, we now see a severe impact with a 50% cut in assistance in that operation. The cuts are affecting access to much-needed mental health and psychosocial support services, to food and nutrition services for some 300 people. It's also affecting access to sexual and reproductive health services, also HIV and TB testing and treatment for many people in that area. Referrals for food assistance for HIV-positive mothers is also severely impacted. I'll conclude by saying that every day that this financial uncertainty continues, of course, will increase the impact on the lives of millions of men, women, and children around the world that have fled their home. It's historic times, historic challenges, but also historic opportunities are rising. It's a time for to see more individuals, governments, private and sector and partners being able to step up and be able to stand for humanity, be able to stand in support of people who have been forced to flee around the world. And this is important not just for the refugees, but the communities that have been so graciously and generously hosting them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan, for all these numbers, really quite incredible effects. Impact. So I'll open the floor to questions in the room, if there is any. I don't see, so let's go to the platform. Jamie Keaton, Associated Press. Jamie, you are on. I'm sorry, we can't hear you. I see your mic has been unmuted, but I can't hear you. You want to try disconnect and reconnect again? I'm afraid we can't hear you, Jamie. Or if you can put the question in writing in the chat, I can read it to Alan. No, his hand is up, but there's no voice. While we're waiting for Jamie maybe to try again to connect, is there any other question to Alan? I don't see other hands up. Oh, here, Nick Cumming Bruce, New York Times. And Jamie, please disconnect and reconnect because we can still not hear you. Sorry. Nick.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the briefing. Could you just give us a bit more clarity on how much money you actually have for health services in 2024 and how much of the cuts that you're talking about are specifically US related, because a lot of different countries are cutting back their foreign aid. So how much of what you're concerned about is specifically related to the USAID and other US government support? Thank you.
Thanks, Nick, for the question. We'll have to get back to you specifically on health, but in general, as you know, we are facing very severe crisis due to the decision by the US, which is our biggest donor, to review its foreign assistance programs, but also from other top donors. So this funding uncertainty is having an obvious impact on our delivery. As our High Commissioner said recently, and as we have just heard, lives are being lost, people are dying. The impact on assistance is very serious. In many cases, we will have to stop providing assistance to people. We cannot yet, we are in the process of reviewing our funding and measures that we will need to take in order to maximize or rather to minimize the impact on the people that we serve, refugees and other displaced people. So at the moment, I cannot give you a figure of, you know, on our funding situation at the moment. But we are pursuing every single opportunity to explain the importance of supporting people forced to flee, and that's what we are trying to do now. So simply put, the work that we are doing is saving lives, protects and advances solutions for forcibly displaced people, and in doing this, we help to stabilize fragile regions and strengthen local economies, and this contributes to security and peace. So a world where refugees find safety makes us all safer. So as many other agencies, we are having to deal with this severe cuts in our budget. We are looking into how to minimize the impact on the refugees. This is our main consideration. But as we have said before, funding difficulties and are not new, unfortunately. You could say that we have been perpetually underfunded. Last year, for instance, our Yemen appeal was only 29% funded, Central African Republic 36%, Myanmar 40%. So what we are trying to do, everything we can to adjust to this reality. The impact on displaced people it continues to be huge, as we have just heard.
Thank you very much. I see that Jamie has not reconnected, so I'll give the floor to Gabriela Sotomayor. Gabriela, you said in the chat you had a question. We have a problem with the question. I don't know what happens. Can my colleague give open the mic of Gabriela?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I had a problem with the connection with the microphone. So 13 million of people are people displaced are going to be affected by the cuts, and the decision of one man, Donald Trump, because is the decision of the president, it's not the American the administration. Is a decision of one person is going to affect 13 million of people? Is that correct?
Shall I take? Yeah, okay. As I said, Gabriela, the funding situation that is affecting us as well as many other agencies has to do with the decision to reduce or to freeze funding. We still don't know how much money we will receive from the United States, but it's not just the United States, although it is our biggest donor. Many of our other top donors have also indicated that they will reduce their contributions this year. So it's a combination of the number of the needs worldwide increasing. The number of conflicts in the world, as we know, have been increasing. The number of emergencies to which we have to respond has been increasing. And at the same time, this uncertainty over funding. We are trying to become even more efficient to make sure that every single contribution goes directly to help refugees. And we have been trying to do this for some time, and we are in the process of reviewing our operations to see what further savings and cuts we can do to our staffing, at our expenditure. But the reality, and there's no other way of putting this, the reality is that this uncertainty over funding will have and is already having an impact on the lives of some of the most vulnerable people on the planet, refugees, other displaced people. And this is having a consequence on the ground, as we have heard.
Thank you very much. You want to add?
No, I just want to add emphasis to the point that this funding, this situation is already, it's devastating, but it's coming on top of long-standing shortfalls in humanitarian assistance, as William rightly noted. And it is important that we act immediately together. And actually want to appreciate that as US is one of the major donors, we also have seen others stepping up to support, and would like to see more support to the refugees and surrounding communities, because the funding cuts and the health consequences are expected to be devastating, and immediate action is needed to be able to avert this. UNHCR is agile, is present, is staying, is delivering to the extent possible. We're having to review how we are working, but then we will continue to do everything possible to limit the impact on the lives of the people, the refugees and the surrounding communities.
Thank you very much, colleagues. I see Jamie must have had also a problem with the connection, because he now is not even in the list of participants. So hopefully, if we get the question afterwards, we'll send it to you. But staying on the same subject, Margaret also has a statement from WHO, and that's on Gavi's support to Gavi.
So many of you have asked us questions about the story from the New York Times about Gavi funding suspension. And we've got a statement that we've just put up. Vaccines are one of humanity's greatest achievements. An estimated 154 million lives have been saved over the past 50 years thanks to global immunization drives as part of the expanded program on immunization, which is led by country governments worldwide, including the US, and supported by global institutions. Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, which includes WHO, UNICEF, and the Gates Foundation as core founding members, was created to widen the benefits of the expanded program on immunization by helping the poorest countries in the world benefit from new life-saving vaccines and increase the coverage of these vaccines. We refer to them as EPI vaccines. These two goals, one, to expand the scope of protection, and the other to expand the scope of protection, have resulted in a greater breadth of protection against an increasing number of vaccine-preventable diseases. This intensified effort, including in the most vulnerable parts of the world, and we have just been hearing what this means, has helped to save more lives and further vaccine equity. As you know, during COVID-19, the wealthy world got 100% vaccination. The poorest countries didn't receive one vaccine a year after some countries were fully vaccinated. The work of Gavi has helped to save more lives and further this vaccine equity, ensuring that children who never receive a single vaccine are reached. Since 2000, Gavi has protected an entire generation, over 1 billion children, against infectious diseases, helping to cut by half child mortality in 78 lower-income countries. From 2000 to 2023, Gavi supported 637 different vaccine introductions, 637 vaccine introductions and vaccine campaigns to protect children around the world against 16 different life-threatening infectious diseases. So not only are vaccines delivering protection and having a high impact, That immunization, and this is what really needs to be understood here, immunization is a best buy in health with a return on investment of $54 for every single $1 invested. Decades of progress have made many vaccine preventable diseases a rarity in the lives of the family. That's why people are not taking it seriously. They are not seeing the diseases that are being prevented by this work. And Gavi has been in the front line to help keep the deadly vaccine preventable diseases at bay, working hand in hand with WHO, UNICEF, and other public and private sector partners. We've just heard of UNHCR's work in public health. Every child has the right to health. Our best defence against infectious diseases is continued investment in life-saving immunisations for all. We cannot turn our backs on protecting all children and all communities from these diseases. Nobody should be mistaken that reversing the gains of the past 25 years of immunisation is anything other than a grave threat to us all. It is critical to continue investment in Gavi so that life-saving immunizations can continue to reach all children. Thank you. The statement is longer, and it's. I'll provide the link.
Yeah. In fact, Christian in the chat was asking if you could just distribute
I'll
this
send the link.
Quickly.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I see two messages. Okay. So that is, I think, what we had in terms of questions on this subject. I would like to thank you very much, Alan, for being with us with your very busy agenda, and thanks to William. Before we leave UNHCR, I think Babar has an update for you on the situation in Myanmar. Babar.
Thank you, Alessandra. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick update for colleagues in terms of the overall number of people who are displaced in the affected region. So as mentioned, the central and northwest parts of Myanmar have the highest number of internally displaced people in the country due to conflict that has been going on now for over 4 years. Last 2 years, we have seen numbers really of numbers of people who are being displaced increase sharply. So some 1.6 million IDPs out of the total 3.5 million live in these years. As it was mentioned, our thoughts are with people who have been affected and also with the colleagues who are the first responders on the front lines. This, as mentioned, you know, is going to increase the hardships that endured by those people who we have been serving with our partners. I mean, we have already been providing emergency assistance, shelter, and running livelihood projects. Back to you, Alessandra. Huge thanks.
Thank you very much. That's very useful updates. Okay. So thank you very much. I'd like now to let you go and go to our last speaker, who's also a colleague of Margaret. And I hope we can connect to him because he has been extremely patient and waiting in the street, I think. We have Dr. Tierno Balde, who is the incident manager for the emergency in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, who is connecting from Goma. Sir, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for your patience. This was a very long briefing with lots of emergencies, but we are very happy to hear from you also on the situation, on the medical situation in DRC. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you really for giving me also this opportunity to talk about DRC. I have heard also, I have learned many things happening in the world currently, a very challenging moment, I think, for the humanity, for all of us. But close to all of these other emergencies, I wanted also to have the chance to talk a little bit about the situation in Eastern DRC. You know, since January 26, the Eastern DRC is facing one of the most critical and acute humanitarian crises, I mean, for the past decade. It's a region, it's not only a country, it's a region because many other countries are currently directly or indirectly affected. I'm talking here about Burundi, about Rwanda somehow, about Uganda, and about Tanzania. the consequences of the ongoing violent clashes which are currently happening, I mean, have led really to thousands of people who have died, to trauma cases, but also to wounded patients. As we are talking now, we just received the medical director of the hospital in Walikale, a territory which is located on the western part of Goma, where recent clashes has happened. And I was informed that almost 600 to 700 people are seeking kind of assistance from that hospital, including many wounded patients without any possibility. No partner, no WHO, no MSF, no ICRC can really join that place. So in a very difficult situation. The same situation is also happening in South Kivu, in Uvira, and also in Ruzizi, at the border of Burundi, where also for the past 3 weeks, we are having many wounded people, you know, without access to care, but also facing a major outbreak of cholera. Clearly, I mean, in the other part of the country, we are seeing all of these peak of outbreaks. In the Maniema province, we are informed about almost the outbreak of cholera with almost 10% of lethality. So 10 people dying out of the 100 people. So it's really a kind of very challenging moment. At the meantime, you know, the mpox, the outbreak of mpox was also having the hotspot here in North Kivu, and which has been now complicated further by really the humanitarian situation. All of this just to highlight, I mean, the challenging situation of this part of the world also, where I think we should not really forget, you know, at the moment about the suffer of the population. In this context, WHO has been around since day one, I mean, for really helping all of the different hospitals providing fuel, providing medicines, providing people, you know, and experts, clinical experts for really addressing this situation. And with partners like Alima, MSF and ICRC, whom we are really supporting by donating all of this material and equipment, we are trying to do our best. But this is really a kind of drop in the ocean, given, I mean, really the massive challenges. I was listening to the situation about Gaza, but here also I can just tell you the territories that you are mentioning host almost 15 million of people. So 15 million of people directly and indirectly affected by this crisis. We are doing our best, again, as I was saying, with the clinician, the emergency medical team that we have really kind of, you know, mobilized from local people here, you know, well-accepted clinicians to go and to provide care, you know, with the support of WHO. WHO was capable of shipping 20 tons of material and medicines, you know, taking the roads, you know, from Uganda to Tanzania by Nairobi, from Nairobi to ship here. And today this is a relief. But again, as I was saying, this is just a drop in the ocean. And maybe just to conclude, I think there is also, I have heard about the consequences of the funding cut. It's also a major issue here, because I can tell you our initial assessment in the North Kivu here have highlighted almost half of the population of North Kivu, which is composed of around 4 million people, will be affected by this funding cut. Directly, many NGOs, international NGOs, partners, WHO, are probably just stopping, I mean, the interventions. Just to highlight that, I can tell you today, almost in Goma, there is a situation of out of stock of vaccine for the routine immunization, I mean, programs. So children will not have any more access to vaccine. The medicines, or again, like the prophylaxis, the post-exposure prophylaxis for limiting the transmission of sexual diseases, this is also, people are really out of that stock. One of the NGO, IMA, which were supported by the US, were just, I mean, not anymore in the possibility of providing those care. WHO tried to provide some of them, some of these kits, around 200 here in Goma, around 300 in North Kivu, but this is not enough. So there is really a need, and those are my final words, you know, to continue emphasizing on the situation here, for sure, for a better peace, to allow more access to the communities, more access to the people who are facing, I mean, the different situations. And at the meantime, also, obviously, having more capacities for deploying medical people, medical supplies, community health workers, mental health workers to address this situation. Over.
Thank you very much for this update, Dr. Balde. Thanks a lot, really. Do we have any question for WHO in DRC? I don't see in the room or on the platform. Let me just, go up here. No. So thanks a lot, Dr. Balde, really, for this very important update. Margaret, you want to say anything before we close?
I think I've said enough. We've sent the link to the vaccination statement, so you should all have that. We've actually pasted the whole thing. And I think that's it from me.
Yeah, Gabriela has a question, but I don't think it's for Dr. Baldi. I think it's for you, but I'll give her the floor. Gabriela.
Yes, thank you very much. Margaret, could you tell us, these vaccines cut funding, how can affect the USA people, the American people? Does that affect them?
Vaccination affects every one of us. That's the reason most of us are healthy adults. We don't realize that pre-vaccination, half the people you look at in any room just wouldn't be there. So yes, it affects absolutely every country. And also, infectious diseases don't care about borders, they don't care about elections, they don't care about governments. So if you don't vaccinate everywhere, anywhere, you're going to be affected everywhere. So, and again, it really is. If you wanted to invest, if you're looking at, what am I going to invest in public health? Vaccination is your best buy. So it's honestly personal opinion, but I don't think it's silly. It's madness not to invest in vaccination.
Thank you so much. So I like now to have free Margaret, who has been with me on the podium for the whole briefing. It's been a long briefing, but I still have a couple of announcements for you. First of all, just to note that we have just issued a statement of the UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon, Janine Hennis-Plasschaert, and I'd like just to read it to you. She says, today's exchange of fire across the blue line, the second such incident in less than a week, is deeply concerning. This is a critical period for Lebanon and the wider region. Any exchange of fire is one too many. A return to wider conflict in Lebanon would be devastating for civilians on both sides of the blue line and must be avoided at all cost. Restraints from all parties is therefore critically needed. It is high time to realize the commitments made in the cessation of hostilities understanding of November 2024 and to implement the UN Security Council Resolution 1701, which contains the formula to ending recurrent cycles of violence. The United Nations remains committed to working with all relevant stakeholders in preventing further escalation and making Resolution 1701 a reality. We've sent it to you, and there is a contact if you have more questions to ask on this issue. And so that is the one announcement. Just wanted to remind you of a press conference. That's going to be an UNCTAD press conference on Thursday, the 3rd of April at 10 a.m. They will present the Technology and Innovation Report 2025. Inclusive Artificial Intelligence for Development. The report and the contents of the press conference are embargoed until the same day, 3rd of April, at 2:30 p.m. Geneva time. And the speakers will be Rebecca Greenspan, the Secretary General of UNCTAD, and Angel Gonzalez-Sanz, the Head of Technology, Innovation, and Knowledge Development Branch of UNCTAD. I think I've told you everything. Oh, and 30th of March, so in 2 days, it's International Day of Zero Waste. We have sent you the remarks of the Secretary General on this important day that he gave to the General Assembly yesterday. I think I really told you everything. I'm just looking at the platform if there is anybody else who would like to say anything. No, I don't see any other hands. So thank you very much for following this very long briefing, and have a nice weekend. Just a reminder before I forget, Monday the Palais is closed. It's an official UN holiday, so we will not be here. And hopefully for you, you will also enjoy some rest. So thank you very much, and I'll see you on Tuesday. Thanks.